Mertuzza versus Gonzalez, Ms. Reyes.
May it please the court and Mr. Beyer, my name is Rebecca Reyes, and I represent actually Mr. Mortaza, not Mortuzza, which is one of the problems we have in this case, who is the petitioner. There is no reasonable fact finder that could find that Mr. Mortaza received actual notice or that he should be charged with receiving notice of the hearing in this case that resulted in his being ordered removed.
You know, the signatures look pretty much alike, don't they?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Are you comparing record page 23 and 94 versus 135?
44 and 135.
Yeah, there is evidence in the record of the way that Mr. Mortaza actually signs his name and has before January 1998 and after. He never actually signed with a G, with Ghulam. He only signed with a G. Other evidence of that, I believe, is on page 23, if that's not what you're looking at right now, Your Honor, and that is evidence on his Illinois driver's license, his New York driver's license, and his Social Security card. They are all signed with an unusual G, or at least a prominent G, that was never spelled out as Ghulam.
When someone steals someone's identity, there's usually a financial motive. Why would someone steal someone's identity and then apply for an adjustment of status?
Great question. There are requirements for adjustment of status, but it requires more than just filling out an application.
If there was a favorable decision on an adjustment of status, it wouldn't benefit anybody other than the named person who applied for the adjustment.
If you can prove that you are that person, that's right. And so if you could show up and say, here's my ID, and I got this ID, and it says that I'm any one of the names that are listed in the application that was filed in January 1998, and you can prove other things, including a lawful entry, then you can qualify for adjustment of status. If you are someone who, for instance, does not have a lawful entry into the United States or cannot prove your lawful entry, then you are disqualified from adjustment of status. So, for instance, if someone else wanted to apply for adjustment of status and needed a lawful entry, they could have used Mr. Mortaza's I-94 information to show a lawful entry. Clearly, that is not apparent here. I mean, there is nothing to say that somebody overtly did this, but the point here is that a reasonable fact finder couldn't have found that it was definitely Mr. Mortaza that filed that application. And because of that, I think that the government wanting you to believe that he didn't meet his burden is disingenuous. What the government is asking is that Mr. Mortaza prove a negative. He essentially, the government is asking that Mr. Mortaza prove that he did not file an application. He filed instead a motion to reopen within months of finding out that he had been ordered removed. In fact, when he voluntarily showed up for an NSEERS special registration in February 2003 is when he was formally advised that he had been ordered removed. He then filed his motion to reopen in April 4th of 2003. What's interesting here and what is implausible about the government's argument is that Mr. Mortaza would have chosen to evade the government. At the time that he submitted, that this 485 was submitted supposedly on his behalf in January 1998, Mr. Mortaza was actually in lawful status. He had entered the country in October 1997. He was given 6 months to be here on a visitor's visa. There is no reason that he would want to evade detection by the Immigration Service. In fact, when he was called to the hearing, he was eligible for relief from removal. So what makes no sense is that he would voluntarily not show up for a hearing at which he could have asked for removal from relief from removal from the United States. He was married on August 13, 2001. The notice to appear was issued against him in June 2000. At that time, he was not, in fact, married. But by the time he was ordered to appear in front of the immigration judge on August 29, 2001, he was married to a United States citizen. And under Velarde, which is a BIA decision allowing for the immigration judge to grant a continuance because a respondent is married to a United States citizen and will be filing for adjustment of status based on that marriage, he was eligible not to be deported and not to be ordered deported at that time. So it is implausible to suggest that Mr. Murtaza, either in 1998 or in 2001, would have been interested in evading government detection in that he was in status when this application was submitted in 1998, and he was eligible for relief from deportation in 2001 when he was called before the immigration court. Now, please keep in mind as we talk about this that another conceptualization of this case is that it actually was not him that was called. And it just depends on how this court chooses to see the inadequacies of the application that was submitted in January 1998. If Mr. Murtaza, in fact, had filled out that application, it is unlikely that he would have mistaken his own name at least once in the application. There are at least two iterations of his name in the application, and they're different. I believe that one is Ghulam Murtaza, the other one is Murtaza Ghulam or Murtusa Ghulam. That's just not his name. And although the government would have you believe that had someone else filled out the application on his behalf, they would have also correspondingly filled out the other preparer section at the bottom of the last page of the application, if, in fact, he had been the one to fill it out, it is unlikely that he would have written his name in two separate different ways and opposing ways in the application itself. The real failure here, then, lies with the immigration court. And in the immigration judge's decision denying the motion to reopen, the immigration judge relies on a credibility finding. He says he evaluates the affidavit that Mr. Murtaza filed in support of his motion to reopen, and he says, oh, this is incredible because of these reasons. Well, please keep in mind that the context in which this motion to reopen was submitted was in an absentia order. And although it's possible that he was not contesting that the notice itself was proper, his receipt of that notice was in fact in question, and it was inappropriate in such a context in which he was going to be ordered deported in absentia that the immigration judge should rely on a credibility finding. And there is nothing in the Immigration and Nationality Act that would have prohibited the immigration judge, if he had concerns about Mr. Murtaza's credibility in particular, from holding an evidentiary hearing on that issue. And because that was such an inappropriate finding in that context, the immigration judge and then the Board of Immigration Appeals both erred in not rescinding the order of deportation in absentia. I will retain the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Reyes. Mr. Beyer.
May it please the Court, Brian Beyer for Respondent Alberto Gonzalez. To respond to Judge Evans's question, why would another alien apply for adjustment of status using Mr. Murtaza or Murtaza's information? The answer provided by petitioner is not valid. It's not true at the time that the adjustment application was filed in 1998, that an alien needed to make lawful entry. Needed to have made a lawful entry in order to qualify for adjustment of status. At that time, an alien could have qualified for adjustment of status irrespective of the way that he entered the country by applying for adjustment under Section 245I and proving that he was the beneficiary of either a visa petition for an immediate relative or an application for labor certification filed by January 14th, 1998. Now, subsequent to that date, in 2000, Congress extended that date. So there would be no need after that for someone to use someone else's identity to apply for the adjustment. I also want to address the point that it's implausible that Mr. Murtuza would have used the address on the application if it weren't his, given that he subsequently qualified for adjustment and was eligible for adjustment at the time of the removal hearing. This overlooks the fact that Mr. Murtuza, by his own evidence, establishes that he was no longer living, if he was living, at 4930 Albany, the address on the adjustment application. More likely, what Mr. Murtuza's obligation here is not to prove a negative, as the petitioner suggests, but to establish that there's a good reason to believe his story, that he was essentially duped into providing information that was subsequently used by someone else. And with respect to that, the heart of it is that Mr. Murtuza has not disassociated himself from the address on that 1998 application. He could have done so, but he didn't.
Just explain how, in the real world, this works. How do you keep INS or Homeland Security or whatever apprised of what your recent address is? If somebody move a lot, how do you do that? You call one of these 1-800 numbers or something?
Well, Your Honor, that's a complicated question to address. That's actually been an ongoing problem with the enforcement of the immigration laws. There have been several GAO reports about the quality of the statistics kept by DHS and legacy INS regarding the completeness of information provided by aliens of changes of address and currentness of registration and other information. And if the court would like to receive a supplemental submission identifying those reports, I'd be happy to provide it. But essentially, as I understand the situation, there is, by statute, an obligation to notify the government of changes of address in Section 265 of the Act. And that is also a basis for...
My question is, how do you do that?
How do you do that?
You say you got to notify the government. I mean, how do you do it? You're from Pakistan or wherever, and you're supposed to let them know that you're just moved. Now, how do you do that?
There are forms that the government has developed for that purpose, and they're available from the INS. As I understand it from reading the GAO reports, they are also supposed to be available through the post offices, but it appears that they are not available through the post offices. Going forward, the United States is supposed to be developing and implementing a more comprehensive and reliable process of tracking non-immigrant visitors than it has now, but that's not yet been implemented. Is that responsive to the court's question?
Yeah, just perplexing that it's so difficult to do this.
Well, historically...
I mean, you guys are the experts here.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't know how to expect somebody who might not even speak English to know how they're supposed to let the government know that they've changed addresses.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess the salient point here, though, is that this is really sort of a different case. That issue is not squarely presented here because the question is, at the time of the decision to commence the proceeding, that was the last, the address 4930 Albany was the last address that the INS had or DHS in Chicago had.
What about these little differences in the name?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know what to make of that.
Is it like saying I'm Dick Posner, I'm Richard Posner, I'm Posner, I'm a Richard, or something like that?
It could be. It's not clear exactly how the application was prepared. Mr. Murtuza's affidavit indicated that he provided his information. It may be that he provided his information orally, and the person who was transcribing it got the name right at the end of the application, but got the name wrong at the beginning of the application, and they didn't try to correct it. It would be speculation on my part to attempt to explain that. But as I mentioned, Mr. Murtuza's obligation was to provide evidence to convince the agency that he was duped, as I mentioned, into providing his information as it was used for another person. He hasn't dissociated himself from that address, which is really the one element of that application that separates it from him, or arguably separates it from him. All the other information is his. Now, had the... There's critical elements of the affidavit here. The affidavit did not assert he did not know anyone at that address. Now, in a footnote, the petitioner's brief makes that assertion, but it's not supported by the record. And the affidavit also did not assert that he did not use the address for any purpose at any time. And that point is implied in the affidavit. It's not directly stated. But no evidence is offered to corroborate it. As explained in the brief that the brief for respondent, there is no objective evidence offered to substantiate a finding that he was actually living anywhere else at the time. And the standard for a motion to reopen is that it needs to be accompanied with a statement of the facts to be proved, as well as affidavits or other evidentiary materials. And what the affidavit in this case is it's very conclusional. It basically advances the point, I didn't know, I wasn't aware, without really providing any information to back that up. And under the circumstances, the board, especially when the agency has the application before it with the signature that is Judge Posner, indicated is very close to the signature that's acknowledged to be Mr. Murtuza's. Certainly, there's a credibility determination that can be made here, and the board made one, and it's reasonable, and it's supported by the record, and doesn't overlook anything in the record or fail to account for any of the evidence. And that's the bottom line here. This is simply a question, what does the evidence show? The agency could have credited his view. It didn't.
Does the record suggest anywhere a motivation for him to, if he actually got the notice and disregarded it, for him to do that?
Well, it could be that... at the time that the notice was served, he did not have any basis for relief under the immigration laws. He did not marry until, as I understand it, early 2001. The notice to appear was served long before that. And so he had an incentive to avoid detection or apprehension at that point. May I take a moment to conclude?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Beyer.
Thank you.
Ms. Reyes, do you have any time? 1-2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Not having a lawful entry is not the only reason that somebody would want to steal your identification. Another reason is that was in effect at that time, as well as if perhaps you had a criminal conviction and you needed somebody else's fingerprints to show that you, in fact, did not have a criminal conviction. There are many other factors that go into the requirements for adjustment of status beyond the one example that I gave. Also, the obligation to notify a change of address needs to be triggered. You have to have filed something that then triggers. Now, when an immigrant enters the United States, they are interviewed immediately, and they are encouraged and must advise the government exactly where they're going to be. At that time, it was not like that.
How do they do that?
Well, they're supposed to go to interviews. They're supposed to show up at immigration. When they come in, their fingerprints are taken, their picture is taken, and they're supposed to notify of any changes in their status or any changes in their residence. They're supposed to follow up with immigration. They can fill out a form if they can find it, if they have representation. Clearly, this person who stole Mr. Morsaz's money did not tell him, oh, by the way, by doing this, you're going to have to change your address with immigration. When he showed up the next day to actually finish the process, the guy had run off and taken his money. Therefore, he never understood that anything had been filed on his behalf, let alone that he triggered the obligation. Also, the Board of Immigration Appeals has recognized that since there is such a gap between when January 1998, when the application was filed, and when June 2000, and then August 29, 2001, that could have possibly been a stale address, that to rely on an address that had been provided by who knows who years before is an unrealistic obligation to put onto Mr. Morsaz. And finally, the extent to which the government has to speculate as to why there were discrepancies within the application is inappropriate. It was inappropriate for the immigration judge to do that kind of speculation in the context of such a severe penalty, such as removal.
Before you sit down, counsel for Homeland Security said that there is the record you could look and find an inference of why someone would want to avoid appearing. Do you have a response to that?
At the time that Mr. Morsaz, assuming that it was actually for him, was that he was called to appear before the immigration judge, he was in fact entitled to relief from removal. And so there is no reason that he would not have wanted to appear before the immigration judge.
He was married at that
He was married to a United States citizen by the time of his hearing.
No, at the time that the notice...
Well, there are two notices, Your Honor. The first is a notice to appear, and that is just a general notice saying that you are being placed in removal proceedings, and the usual course of circumstances is at the bottom it says you must appear at a date to be announced at a place to be set. So that's what it says, and it's not accompanied by an actual date to appear. There is no response that you need to take to receiving a notice to appear. That was issued in June of 2000. A separate notice then goes out telling you where and when to appear, and that is a firm date and a firm place, and you must appear before an immigration judge. By the time that second notice, which would have actually required his presence, was sent to this address, he was eligible for relief from deportation and would have had no reason to avoid detection.
Okay,
thank you very much,
Ms. Reyes. Okay, our last argument for the day, the combined Riley-Snyder case, is Mr. Storino.